This episode of Access Utah was originally broadcast in May of 2022.
Welcome to Access Utah. I'm Tom Williams. From a backwoods church in Arkansas to the disappeared town of St. Thomas, buried beneath the waters of Lake Mead, award-winning essayist Phyllis Barber travels roads both internal and external, reflecting upon place and perspective, ambition and loss in her new book, The Precarious Walk. As a child growing up in the Mojave Desert, she witnesses the massive power of the Hoover Dam and the fiery rip in the sky from the Nevada test site. As an adult, she searches for meaning through music, movement, and human connection, examining her Mormon upbringing and profound ways people and landscape impact one another and the sudden loss of her first child.
I'm happy to be here.
I want to read this here. You say it's useful to know why you've become the person standing in your shoes and ask what and who you are. I think this is at least some of what you're doing with the with these essays, correct?
Yes, definitely. And I believe that I wanted to encourage other people to do the same thing.
Yes. what is it that happens, do you think, that, you know, a lot of us don't do that? What happens when you do that examination?
Well, one thing that happens is you find out it's not quite the same as the story you've created around it. So it's much more complicated and complex than we could imagine. But it's good to re-examine the stories we tell about ourselves.
And then I think you've written that something, you know, happens, but you make discoveries, including about your, I guess, your own self when you write about
yourself. Definitely. And it's kind of a surprise. It's like you may not be the same person you once thought.
Yeah. Do you have your book with you?
I do.
I wonder if you could read just from the very beginning, the first essay, "O Say Can You See." It kind of sets the scene here in Boulder City. Maybe the first page, and then over, including the first full paragraph on the next page.
Okay. Excuse me. I'm sorry. My morning voice. Mm-hmm. "Oh, say, can you see?" Over the radio microphone into the nation's and FDR's ears, my grandma sang the Star-Spangled Banner. "Oh, say, can you see?" she sang. "The woman who ironed for nickels and dimes. Everybody in Boulder City, Nevada recommended her for the dam's dedication program. They'd heard her sing at funerals, beautifully enough to make them cry even more than they might have. What so proudly we hail." A big black open car full of VIPs delivered her home from the ceremony. She probably waved goodbye longer than those men expected, as if it were the last time she'd be waving goodbye. Her hand pausing in the air, both wanting to push the car along and wanting to keep it close to her. I can see her there, maybe because I somehow feel connected to that woman and her difficult life, dressed in her Sunday dress, most likely black cotton, with low, broad-heeled shoes. She must have sung by the memorial in between those stylized statues, massively chested men wearing tall, stiff wings pointing skyward. Her notes must have hovered high above the Colorado from where she stood on top of Hoover Dam, now diverting water to be used for the benefit of humankind. I hope those 96 men who died building the dam were given fluffier wings by the purveyor of angel equipment. Those brown wings wouldn't lift anybody anywhere. I remember that dam and the stories about Grandma, but there was something else about growing up in the Mojave Desert that will never leave a mind. A rip in the sky, a test, a gash that showed the sky's insides for a minute. I thought about my Band-Aid box when I saw it, a funny thing to think about then, but I did. I could never have unwrapped enough Band-Aids to patch the desert, even if I'd pulled the red string exactly down the side crease without tearing into that flat side of the paper where the red letters are printed. After that first fire in the blank sky passed, the heaven's blood and the earth's dust made a big cloud, a busy one that drifts over my mind more often than I'd like.
So we have the dam and the resulting Lake Mead. We have the Nevada test site there as well. I love that that metaphor. You can never unwrap enough Band-Aids to patch the desert.
The desert is always a big and enigmatic thing, enigmatic place to me. I loved it, and it was very alien too.
Yeah. I think your dad took you, this was not uncommon. Your dad took you to witness, at least one test.
Right. Well, in Boulder City, Nevada, there was a small rim of mountains before you would go into Las Vegas or Henderson. And so we stood behind that mountain, and the clouds and all that were blown eastward. So we were supposedly safe, but it seems strange that our father would take us to see it, but he was very excited about what was happening.
Then he said something, it resonates, logical at the time. He said, we're referring to America, now we're safe. Nobody can ever touch us or something like that.
Right. That's how my father felt. And he was very, very proud of that bomb. And I mean, as a child, all you can do is listen and watch and learn from what your parents say.
Maybe have you talk a little bit about your parents. You say your mother grew up in Idaho, solid farm folks.
Definitely.
And you say this something interesting. You say, and she met this drifting man. Your father ended up in the desert, but you say something in her never moved there.
Right. I think she always was an Idaho girl, and really loved that solidity much more than she loved the Nevada craziness and the blowing wind and all the dust. And although Las Vegas is a different place now than it was then, so it's much more civilized than it was at the time.
And I guess she would say periodically, hey, let's move. Why are we out here in the desert, right?
Right. And I always felt her longing, even if she didn't say very much. But I think over the years she finally accepted the fact she was there and made the best of it. But for about 10, 15 years, I think she wanted to go back to Idaho.
Mm-hmm. You write about you take trips back to Idaho to visit the relatives, right? It's such a different world, a different culture. I mean, same religion, but different, really different cultures.
Definitely a different culture. It took me a lot of years to figure that out, that we have, I mean, Las Vegas has its own culture. And you think your own culture is the only one. And when you get older, you go, wait a minute, that's not quite right.
Tell us about your dad. You write, contrast to your mom, he belonged in the desert.
Right.
You're right.
They lived in Ely, Nevada, and crisscrossed the desert all the time, and they lived in Boulder City, and they lived in parts of Idaho, the southern Idaho. And his father was always looking for a job, and it would only stay with a job for about 6 months, if that long. And so the family was continually moved about, and my father was not a rough-and-ready type of guy, and I think his father wanted more of that from him, and he didn't have it to give. So it created a bit of a conflict between them.
What was life like there in Boulder City? You say later on, I want to have you talk about Las Vegas, different kind of desert, but what was life like there in Boulder City?
Well, Boulder City was a government town which was built to build the Hoover Dam, and for a long time there were guards at the gate. You couldn't get in, you had to go past the guards to get in, and if you'd been drinking or anything like that, they wouldn't allow you in because they didn't want to jeopardize the situation of the building of the dam. So after the dam was finished, Boulder City remained a federal reservation until, I think, the 50s, when it was made an independent town. But it never did develop the same culture as Las Vegas. There was a 3.2 beer salon or something like that, and that was the extent of it. It never got any more than that. It was a very ordered town, and as I said earlier, it was a government town, so a lot of the people who helped build the dam stayed there and they needed people to run the dam, so they kept those people there. So anyway, but when moving to Las Vegas was truly different.
Before we get there, you write about a trip to the dam. I guess you're taking a tour. You wander off, and the tour guide gets after you. But your description of peering over the dam. I think your uncle even kind of dangles you over. I'd vertigo reading that. scary.
Well, my uncle worked there, so he wasn't afraid of it, but it scared me to death. It's a very big, tall dam.
And then, people would talk about, because there's a bit of a slope, right? It's not completely, 90 degrees.
Right.
You talk about, you could maybe slide down there. Of course, you'd die. In fact, you write about one guy committed suicide off the dam.
Yeah, that's the only one I ever heard of.
You write, 96 people died constructing the dam.
Right, and there are a lot of stories about that the men were buried in the dam and left in the cement, but that is not true. The dam was built in forms, and the concrete was about 3 feet deep, or else it never would have dried. So if somebody fell in, which they did, and fell into the concrete, they were able to get them out.
And so you contrast this to Las Vegas, where you moved. I'm not sure how old you were when you moved.
About 11.
About 11. There was order in Boulder City, right? You felt kind of safe. It was a very structured government town.
Right, and then the elementary school was excellent, and a lot of the teachers there had been hired during the building of the Hoover Dam, and which was also during the Depression. So we just had excellent teachers. And, it was a really, I'm so glad I was able to grow up there, or not grow all the way up, but grow partly the way up.
Mm-hmm. And you would, would you go out in the desert, at least the edges of town, that kind of thing?
Oh, definitely. And I would ride my bike out there sometimes, and sometimes you'd see snakes, sometimes you wouldn't, but you'd see a lot of horned toads and all that kind of stuff. But I was always so curious about the desert and what was out there.
Mm-hmm. So then you moved to Las Vegas. You're 11 years old. I wanted to just read this sentence. Landing there, talking about Las Vegas, felt like being shot onto the barren surface of the moon. It was too hot, inhospitable, a harsh place. Tell me about Las Vegas circa 1954.
Well, when we arrived there, we were truly on the edge of the desert. Right across the street from our house was sheer desert, although it's been way built up since that time. But so it felt like we were moving to the very edge of the desert and to the wind, and the wind blew terribly, which is, I guess, not quite so bad now because the dust has all been made into homes, et cetera. But I remember walking to school and the wind blowing, and I just thought it was a very inhospitable place. So that's how it felt after Boulder City.
Yeah. You said the houses were kind of flimsy, at least at that point as well.
Yes, yeah. There were no basements, and I guess I'm used to Idaho and Utah where everybody has a basement. But there was nothing like that in the desert.
What was the culture like? You were kind of on the edge of town. Did you guys go to the... What was the Las Vegas Strip like at that time?
There wasn't a whole lot of the Las Vegas Strip at the time. Howard Hughes came in 1965, and I graduated from high school in 61. So that's when things began to change, when he arrived in town. And I guess some of the mafia was there earlier, and there were a few hotels. Like, I can't remember, the Desert Inn and the Flamingo, I think. But it just really expanded after 65.
Hmm. And you write that this was hopefully going to be a step up for your dad. You can be able to bring in more money, insurance salesman, right? But it didn't really work out that way.
No, it didn't. There were quite aggressive salesmen in Las Vegas, and my dad just wasn't an aggressive kind of guy. He was wonderful in his own way, but he should never have been an insurance salesman. And the other people were, like I say, more aggressive, the other salesmen. And gradually my dad kind of faded away. It was a I was able to witness that because I was a teenager at the time. And anyway, it was kind of a sad tale because he had been a very strong man and a well-known man in Boulder City, and then Las Vegas, he kind of disappeared.
He wanted to be a writer, didn't he?
He did want to be a writer, and he should have been. He's a very creative kind of guy, but, you know, he had to support a family, and so that was air in the air.
Yeah. Was he able to witness you becoming a writer?
He did. He did a little bit, but he's been gone about 25 years now. Yeah, I think about 22 years, but and he was not well for the last 10 years, so he didn't get to see a lot of what I did, but he knew that I was writing, so that was some consolation to him.
Now, you write that, of course, you're a teenager here in Las Vegas. It's, you know, at least when you first came, it was like being shot onto the barren surface of the moon, you write, but you say you had a determination, I would matter here somehow. And you did make it. You became a Las Vegas Rhythm Met.
Oh, that's big time stuff. the Rhythm Mets were actually on the Ed Sullivan Show, which some of the listeners will remember and some will not. But it was a big show that everybody wanted to be on, a talent show. And the Beatles were on it, and Elvis Presley, et cetera, et cetera. But the Las Vegas Rhythm Mets actually performed on the Ed Sullivan Show the year before I got in. And it was a really big time thing to be to make the Rhythm Met.
I wonder if I could have you read another passage here. Page 218. This is from the very end of the book here. 218.
Okay.
Starting with that first full paragraph, The Desert is Subtle.
The end?
Maybe to the end. Yeah. Raises some interesting points maybe we can talk about after you read it.
Okay. The desert is subtle. It lies behind the facade of what men have tried to build. It tries to send people away with its bitter wind and searing sun, but it has taught me to find my way through, to accept me whether or not I'm beige, the color of sand, if that's what I am. Quiet, reserved, I'm a creature who has found a way to live in the midst of challenges. My response is not easy to track. I could be the desert itself. It's true that we are all part of other places we've lived. In my case, the Bay Area of California, Salt Lake City and Park City, Utah, Denver, Colorado, Rochester, Minnesota, and the many places I've traveled, Arkansas, South Carolina, Tibet, India, Iceland, Spain, England, Ecuador, etc. But a large part of who I am will always be a metaphor, a piece of sand warmed by the sun. How I love to be warmed by the sun, especially when it doesn't burn too hot. Though it took years to come to peace with my childhood and put my geography in perspective, even while Las Vegas became different from what I'd known, I've discovered that it doesn't matter whether or not I'm a high flyer among all those people who came to Clark County to escape or find a new life. I don't have to be a showgirl or drive a pink Cadillac. I know how to find shade in the holes that keep me out of the heat, and I'll always be a creature of sand and sun. That's what those scars on my thighs tell me, the ones where I once lost the mass of what covered me, my skin lost to that unholy yet holy landscape. All of us are from a specific geography, captured in an indelible memories, sights, smells, and sounds. It's useful to know why you've become the person standing in your shoes and to ask what and who you are. There could be a desert, a rise of mountains, the flatness of plains, or the swell of ocean in your history, the smells, the angles of light, the grass or no grass, snow or too much sun. Maybe you were surrounded by water or by sand, maybe green fields. Unwind it, understand it. Tell your story as I've told mine in so many ways. At least tell this story to yourself. Tell of the places where you wander in your thoughts, even if you're not aware you're wandering.
That's what we talked about that a little earlier, right?
Yes.
Tell the story to yourself. Tell the places where you wander in your thoughts. I want to talk about this. The subtitle gets into this, Essays from Sand and Sky, because the book is The Precarious Walk. What What is it about the West, about the desert, that you respond to so much and that has formed you, you say?
Well, I just think it surrounded me when I was growing up, and it was kind of like the desert was always out there. There'd be a little bit of civilization, but there would always be a big desert and big stretches of sand and a huge sky, and it was blue, too blue some of the time. But it was kind of like that became my soul. It was because it was so much. I really think we're affected by our environment and more than we realize. So that's why, and the desert always, I even go back there now, and I love to be in Lake Mead National Park, I think it's called. But they've kept it all pristine and all really deserty, and I love it. It speaks to me.
You've said that being in the West, we have a sense of ease with space and wide openness.
Mm-hmm. I think so, and I don't know how long that will continue or if it is the same for everyone now, but driving even to Idaho every summer as we did, there would always be great stretches of nothing, the landscape it always felt like little towns were here and there, but it was like that was man's effort. Mm-hmm. So I always related to the big space.
What do you think that does to us here in the West? All that wide open space, you know, big sky. It seems like endless space sometimes.
Well, I taught back at Vermont College in Montpelier, Vermont, and there were so many trees, and it was like, this feels a slightly bit claustrophobic because I'm used to, you know, not having this, not having so much green. I think what it does to a person is it makes a person, it made me feel very independent, but like there was a lot of room to be other than what you were supposed to be or what somebody told you you should be. So I think the desert is rather a remarkable place.
It's time for a break. Let's take a little break here, and we'll be back with Phyllis Barber. Her new essay collection is The Precarious Walk. The subtitle is Essays from Sand and Sky. We'll have more following this break.
This episode of Access Utah was originally broadcast in May of 2022.
Thanks for listening to Access Utah. I'm Tom Williams. We're joined for the hour by writer Phyllis Barber. Her new collection of essays is The Precarious Walk, Essays from Sand and Sky. It's out from Torrey House Press. So Phyllis Barber, before we get jump into more of the essays here, I was reading on your website, by the way, phyllisbarber.squarespace.com. You have a list of favorite books. And I agree with all your picks here. One stood out. I have trouble articulating why this is so good. You list Housekeeping from Marilyn Robinson. I wonder if you could maybe do a better job than I can. I try to tell people how good this book is, but you've listed on your best books. What is it about this book?
Well, that was the first time I had read Marilyn Robinson, and she, I guess, has published quite a few books since then, but I haven't liked any of them as well as I liked that first one, Housekeeping. And I mean, they're all good, but that one was especially good. And it talked about really not being able to keep a house, to keep it, not to clean it. But I thought, maybe it's partially because I grew up in the desert, but it was like, those houses would deteriorate after a time, and they would be gone. And if somebody's not there keeping it up and paying attention to it, it goes with the wind and the sun. So I just really was attracted to that premise and to the way she writes. I think she wrote that book beautifully.
Mm. You've also listed Gabriel Garcia Marquez's classic 100 Years of Solitude. There's some others here as well. You've listed Flannery O'Connor as a literary, I guess, an influence. Tell me about that.
Well, I just think she's a wonderful storyteller, and she was very Catholic, I believe, and so she was always writing in response to some of that that she garnered from her Catholic upbringing, and I guess I related to that because I was raised very strictly in a religious context. And I loved her sense of humor and the way she was very daring, in my opinion. And it gave me a little more chutzpah, a little more courage to blast out of things. And those are the best words I could come up with. But I really, I have had much admiration for her work.
You've done a lot of travels, and a lot of it's been a spiritual search, hasn't it? In fact, on this website, you have a picture of you with a camel. That's, I guess, emblematic of a lot of your travels. The title essay is called The Precarious Walk Away from Mormonism, subtitle of the essay All the Time with a Stitch in My Side. Tell me a little bit about that. What your search for spirituality, I guess, maybe beyond your Mormon roots.
Well, like I say, I was raised very religiously and very much in very tight to the whole religion. And there are many, many good things about it. I have a great affection for it. And I came to the point where it was like there are a whole lot more people in the world and there are a whole lot more religions, and I want to know what those are all about. I don't want to just accept one thing as the only way to think about things. And so for 20 years, I didn't go to my original church at all. I went to all kinds of different churches and went and had a lot of different experiences, and I loved that. I loved seeing people worship and people trying to find that connection with something greater than themselves. And I saw it everywhere. Although when I was in Tibet, I have to say, I tried to talk to some Buddhist monks, but there were Chinese people there as well, and the Buddhist monks were afraid to speak out as they might have otherwise because they would be censored.
You went to Tibet. You talked with, I think, went to Peru, right? Talked to some shamans there as well.
I'm sorry, I didn't hear that.
Oh, I'm sorry. Yeah, to Peru, I think, as well. All over. Tell me about you went to a Baptist church.
Yes, and I love that. I've actually went to quite a few Baptist churches, and I was teaching one semester at the University of Missouri, and there was a second Baptist church, I believe it was called, and it was all black, and I would go to that faithfully every Sunday because I loved the choir. And I loved the way that preachers would preach their sermons, and it just stirred something in me. And I have an essay in the book called Sweetgrass, and it's about my visit to a little tiny Second Baptist church in South Carolina, I believe, and how affecting that was, how much that, you know, reached my very deepest parts of me. So I have a lot of respect and admiration and feel connected to people who are engaged in a worshipful state, whatever that might be.
What was it about the Baptist worship that is contrasting?
I'm sorry, I can't hear you very well.
Oh, can you hear me now?
Yes, I can hear
okay.
you now.
What is it about the Baptist worship, for example, contrasting to the worship you grew up in?
Well, what I did see was a lot more of a demonstrative spirit from the preacher. He would really get in and you could almost, as I'm a musician, and they could almost hear the rise of the speech to the pinnacle and then the fall afterward, the denouement. And I just thought, I loved getting all worked up like that, or watching it happen too. And I loved the music because the people who sang and the people who marched down the aisles in their robes, their beautiful gold silk robes, whatever they were. But it's like something in it, something in them really spoke to me, something about them really caring and really hoping that there was a connection and believing there was a great connection to something greater than ourselves. Mm.
So in some of these searches, there's you're attracted to movement, right? Dance, rhythm is a way of worship or a method, I guess.
Well, definitely. And even in the Baptist churches, or the, I guess I would have to call them Baptist, but I seems like I went to others as well. But there was a rhythm to their lectures or their sermons, and I don't know. I guess I'm really respond to things that seem to be larger than what we ordinarily operate in. So the pattern's there.
I guess the there's still a pull there, a tug from the religion you grew up in. You write about a trip to a cannery. I wonder if you tell me about that.
Oh, I went to a cannery with a friend of mine who was the daughter of a very high person in the Mormon church, and I always respected that about her, and she was a really good person, and we went to the cannery together, and I loved working in concert with other people and just being a part of the whole thing. And so what I love about my religion I grew up in was the connectedness and the community, and people who are doing things together. And I really admire the Mormons for all of their effort that they're making around the country when there are disasters and big problems. They're one of the first ones to be there. So that was a salute to that.
You studied piano performance. In fact, you considered that as a career for a while. Tell me a little bit about that. I guess you obviously must have practiced piano much more than I did growing up. I was one of those kids where, you know, I had a little bit of interest, but I didn't stick with it. You were pretty good.
Well, I always liked to practice, so that was the difference. And when I taught piano, I had a lot of students who wouldn't practice, and it was like, I'd talk to their mothers and say, please, you know, they don't want to take lessons. Don't make me suffer. And don't make them suffer. But anyway, I was really enjoyed playing the piano, and I wanted to be a concert pianist at one time. And then I got, and I graduated with a music performance degree in piano. And I don't know whether to call them recitals. They weren't concerts. I don't know the difference between a recital and a concert. But anyway, I performed some very beautiful and difficult music, and then I had children, and it was like, wait a minute, I can't do all of this. And to be a concert artist requires 5 or 6 hours a day, and I didn't have that time to give, and I didn't want to give that much. So at that time, I decided I would write instead. And so I got up at like 4 in the morning, and I'd write for a couple hours before my children would get up. But I always loved music, and I accompanied thousands of people, literally thousands. So.
Wow, yeah. Both are creative outlets, right? Are there similarities? I'm talking about, piano, music, and writing.
There definitely are similarities, and some people say it's not, have said to me, is that it's not fair, you're good at a lot of things. And I said, well, I really think they're all connected. So I think there's a much of a connection between writing, because you're trying to, and in my piano playing, I'll go back to that, I always tried to really speak what the composer wanted to say. And I was very dedicated to that. And I think as I wrote, I wanted to say how I felt about everything. And I finally came to the conclusion that people can't argue with you about your own experience. If you try to create a fact and say this is how this is, that this way or that, then people can argue with you. But it's like if you talk about your own experience, you get to be the final arbiter of that.
This episode of Access Utah was originally broadcast in May of 2022.
You're listening to Access Utah. I'm Tom Williams, and we're talking with writer Phyllis Barber. Her latest book is The Precarious Walk, Essays from Sand and Sky. It's out from Torrey House Press. So Phyllis Barber, I want to have you read another passage here. This is page 59. This is just section 11 from your essay, Ode to the Mojave. Before we get there, maybe we could set this up. This is, you're talking about St. Thomas, This is a town that was drowned by Lake Mead when the dam was built, right?
Right.
And so you you drive out to a certain point, then you get on your bike and bike into the Lake Mead. I'm not sure, monument or park or recreation area.
The remains.
Timing is important here because Lake Mead has receded enough that at least part of St. Thomas is now exposed again after, I guess, probably decades.
All of it is exposed.
Oh, well, all of it, yes, yes.
It's really, the lake has really gone down.
I'll maybe have you read this.
Okay, the whole 11?
11, yes.
Okay, the remains of St. Thomas have brought me to breathe the clear desert air once again, and to be wary of holes where scaly creatures watch for intruders. This is my land, this sand, these rocks, these weeds that dry up and tumble, even though it is called a land best left to itself. I could have been a native woman with red paint smeared across my cheeks who understands the barren, never-ending hills and that there are others, other natives, other tribes that want what I have coaxed from the land when need is stark. I could have been a pioneer woman building an adobe house, birthing and burying. I was a child splashing in the waters of Lake Mead with my father standing close by. I am a woman wondering about the naming of names and the busyness of human effort to subdue the earth and engineer it into something habitable. Call me whatever you want. I don't need a name. Names are useful for a while, the ones found on dried scraps of paper, on pages in books, in libraries and museums, and on microfiche, in between floods and sandstorms. The wind will blow. It will tear paper that the sun has yellowed and curled at the edges. The rain will fall. Water will blur the ink. Whatever names we call ourselves and those who came before us, they remind us what has been here, what preceded us. Names. Yes, names. Transient, flying through the sky, blowing in the dust, names. My real father, mother, lover is the wind, the sun, the smell of water gathering in clouds, the curtains of rain. I am a creature made of lizard skins, sagebrush, horsetail grass, and rainwashed sand. Once in a while I flash brilliance like heat lightning or the pink prickly pear blossom, but mostly I'm subtle like the desert and this dust, my land, which can never, ever be owned. I have been here before. I am here now. I will leave again, following the way of the desert.
Beautiful. You say I'm a creature made of lizard skin, sagebrush, horsetail grass, and rainwashed sand. That's a beautiful phrase. You say earlier in this essay, you point out the only reason you're able to visit, this town now exposed, is that the water has receded. You write, they created a colossal lake, but now even though the dam will probably last into infinity, what about the water?
It's certainly facing us right now. Both Lake Mead and Lake Powell are getting, you know, much less than they once were, much, much, much less. To the fact that there was a wonderment if Lake Powell will even be there.
It's certainly true. I want to talk a little bit. We talked about desert, of course. You write a lot about desert in the book. Are there other places?
I'm losing you again.
Oh, sorry. Can you hear me now?
I can't hear you.
Oh, can you hear me?
I'm sorry, I can't hear.
Okay. Can you hear me? Okay, great. I'm wondering about the cities and the effect, maybe the interaction you've had with, you on those cities, the cities on you in terms of place. So, Salt Lake City, Park City, where you are now. You've lived in Colorado.
I live in Park City, Utah now.
Yeah, you live in Park City now, but you've lived in, Salt Lake, Colorado, et cetera, et cetera. What marks of those places left on you, do you think?
Well, I was really glad to live in Colorado for a while because I think Utah has a very set culture. I don't think it's quite as much as it used to be, but it's like being in other cultures and being able to breathe more freely. So I especially loved my time in Minnesota, which was about a year and a half. And it was like these people have their own culture, and it's different from mine, and they think about things differently. And I love that exposure.
We talked earlier in the program about your mom and dad, right? Are both of them gone now?
Yes.
But I wonder about that. We talked about the effect that they, we talked about them, right? I wonder if you talk a little bit about the effect that they had on you. I guess, you know, obviously as with all of us, our mother and father have a big effect, and there's a through line there, you know. What do you think from each of them has affected you?
Well, my mother was very straight-laced and very sure of everything, and she very much believed in Mormonism, and she would have no other way with any of us. My father had a more, I hate to say interesting, but a more mind that would consider more options, and I tended to side with that because I liked the idea of a bigger place and not something tied down so tightly. So that influence was great with my mother and my father, and I have respect for both of them and for both of what they had to teach me and give me. And I've come to think I had really good parents, and I'm glad for the kind of the difference between them.
Of course, we talked about Las Vegas. I don't know if you go back or have been back recently. What do you think about modern Las Vegas contrasted to the, you know, early Las Vegas that you lived in?
Well, the modern Las Vegas is so huge and so spread out. I mean, I get lost when I go there now, and I want to go to the old Las Vegas. The writer's block, I'm giving, which is a bookstore there, I'm giving a reading there on June 3rd, but it's close to the old Las Vegas High School, and that's in the very middle of the city, very much the downtown, and that's where I want to be. I want to be with those familiar places. But so much of Las Vegas is stretched out everywhere now. In Henderson and Las Vegas, there's hardly a barrier, and there used to be quite a few miles between. So I don't even, in a way, I don't like to go back there now because it's so different. And that's, gambling is huge there, and showgirls and all that kind of, it's a different mentality. And I remember wanting to buy into all of it when I was in high school, and it was like I needed to buy into all of it. But now I see it as a culture, as a way of, one way of life.
Mm-hmm. I'll talk a bit about your journey as a writer and maybe advice you would give to writers. I guess you started out, you got a chance to write for Utah Holiday Magazine in Salt Lake. That's
right.
One of your early gigs, right?
Mm-hmm.
Did you think then that you'd be able to move from that to writing books, writing essays and collections and such?
Well, I remember I was writing essays mostly for Utah Holiday, and I love to write essays, and hence this collection. I've written it over a period of 25 years, and I've chosen the essays I liked best. But when I was writing for Utah Holiday, I would take different subjects and, Confessions of a Snowplow Queen was one of them, and Raising a Rock and Roll Band was another. I can't remember all of them now. It's so long ago. But I did hone my craft, and Paul Swenson was a wonderful editor at Utah Holiday, and he gave me suggestions, and then I decided to go and study at the University of Utah, study writing and fiction writing. So that's how that all got started, and I started writing short stories, which sounded more autobiographical than fictional.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm suspicious of how the author is influenced by his or her life.
Yeah, inevitable, I guess, right?
Inevitable.
Yeah. What advice do you give to young writers? I mean, you teach, I think you've taught writing. What advice do you give?
Right now I teach for Osher, but I've taught for a lot of years, and I taught at Vermont College of Fine Arts, and I teach for Osher, and I've taught some workshops in Park City, and I always try to tell people, say, please write what, just write. Don't try to be good and don't try to be fantastic and just write. Just tell your story and tell the things that you have to say that nobody else knows about, because if you don't tell about your story, nobody else will. And so I really enjoy encouraging people to tell their own story.
Well, just a couple of minutes left. I want to read this sentence, have you react to it. This is Phyllis Barber. I value this life so much more since I've gotten older and have come to a place of gratitude for my own particular journey. It's a sacred thing.
And do you want me to comment on that?
Yeah, yes.
Well, I mean, I do. I remember when I was younger really wanting to be somebody else or another person who seemed more successful and all that. And over the years, I've come to really appreciate who I am and what I have to give and what I have to offer. And so I don't know if it's just maturation or writing or whatever has caused that change, but I feel very happy to be myself and to tell my own stories. And I remember one time somebody criticized me for always talking about myself, and I thought, well, I mean, I've written other things that aren't about me quite a few things, actually. So, but telling one's own story still fascinates me, because you tell one element of the story and then you realize that's not all of it. So it's a kind of an introduction to a much larger palette.
Well, the book is The Precarious Walk. The subtitle is Essays from Sand and Sky, and it's out from Torrey House Press. Well, the book is out and available from Torrey House Press. Phyllis Barber, thank you so much. Appreciate it.
Thank you so much.
And thanks, everyone, for listening to Access Utah.
Every rural person and place has a story. Change is part of that story. Rural Utah at a Crossroads is part of the Smithsonian Traveling Exhibit Crossroads, Change in Rural America, which explores the changing meaning of rural life and identity. Utah Humanities is touring Crossroads to 8 rural communities across Utah in 2024. As part of the tour, Utah Humanities and Utah Public Radio are partnering with exhibition hosts to interview local residents about change in their communities.
This interview was recorded in cooperation with the USU Blandin campus.
I'm from the community of White Mesa, south of Blandin, from the band of Tamarack, Wash, and Allen Canyon, Avican area of the Ute people. And we've lived here for thousands of years, and we shared this land with everyone. And it's something that we have long known of, the importance of this landscape and the energy that it has of helping all of us here. Up in the drainages of Allen Canyon and Cottonwood Wash is where my people live during the summer months, and we know that you can come out here and basically get lost out in the vast openness, and having that knowledge of the history with our people, it is just like going home when I travel to up into the canyon. People from all the world come here now and want to see it. And one of their main questions, where are all the Indians? And they're like, back in India. We are still surviving and still existing here and sharing this land with everyone. And it's something that my grandfather said of how my connection with the environment was being able to understand the nature, the wildlife. And so the songs that I learned that my grandfather taught me is in a G minor scale, which is the sound of nature. And that scale is unique. I mimic the many animals with my music and my flute. And that's a connection I understand and I have with our people. And the flute has been one of the instruments to share our culture, and it's taken from a few stories of what the flute is used for. It was for healing and for courting, of course. Different tribes have that same bottom line story, and which is unique because I have enjoyed learning from different tribes of their stories of the flute and how the connections there and how we as indigenous people have shared that uniqueness of the music. But he has taken me many places, even across the pond over to Europe. And there are many other projects that I work with, like during the centennial of the state of Utah. I was quite busy. I helped with the soundtrack of a rock art. And it's a photographs of rock art from all over the state of Utah called Sacred Images. And I composed the soundtrack to that exhibit. Same year, I was asked to do an opera called Dreamkeepers, which was a modern opera. And I actually played a song called The Eagle's Cry, and I used the flute to make that sound. And so that was one of the projects that was unique in a way of sharing the Ute culture in that unique opera. Later on, I was asked to be a part of the 2002 opening ceremony of Winter Olympics. And so just many of the many adventures I've gone through so far and places I thought I'd never venture off to. But my music is a part of that connection, and sharing it with everyone is the important part of the enjoyment of this world that we live in.
Rural Utah at a Crossroads is produced by Maya Shumway. It is a collaboration between Utah Public Radio, Utah Humanities, and the community hosts of Crossroads, Change in Rural America, a Smithsonian Museum on Main Street exhibition made possible in the Beehive State by Utah Humanities. Support for Museum on Main Street has been provided by the United States Congress. Broadcasts of Rural Utah at a Crossroads on UPR is supported by our members,